Good morning, and thank you for joining me on the Path to Liberty. I'm Michael Bolden with the 10th Amendment Center, and this is the show for March 6th, Monday, 2023. And yesterday in history, March 5th, all the way back in 1770, was one of the most important events on the road to American independence, the massacre in Boston. And if there was anything that really solidified colonial opposition to things like arbitrary centralized power and large permanent standing armies, you have it right there. You find both of those items listed as grievances in the Declaration of Independence, and you can even see a lot of that message carried forward to the ratification debates over the Constitution some years later. I want to kick it off with just a very brief overview here from an article we published by Dave Benner, who of course does awesome work on this. He points out that five Bostonians died and six were seriously wounded, including a young boy. This incident did much to exacerbate tensions between the colonists and the crown. Firebrands such as Samuel Adams and Paul Revere quickly branded the incident, I like how he put it there, quickly branded the incident as the massacre and worked quickly to depict the event as an egregious assault against a peaceable people. Additionally, Dave writes, they used the episode to initiate a boycott of British goods. And of course, part of the independence of being able to do that was self-sustaining and like things like food production and things like that. That's what helped them be more successful, which the two rallied support for over the coming months, Revere, Adams, and others. In the court of public opinion, Dave points out that public unrest towards the British grew to an all-time high, at least at that point. Now, there are some legitimate historical questions about culpability in the whole event. But if you think about it, and I think a lot of the people, the patriots, the revolutionaries' position were, like, if you didn't have arbitrary power and you weren't garrisoning and stationing large standing armies here, this type of a scenario never would have come up. But it's still an interesting situation. You've got a lot of names that you'll be familiar with. But Dave's article goes into a lot of that history. But most important in that story is that Dave calls it a pivotal step on the road to independence. And I think he was absolutely right. And I think it was so important in Boston for so many years that it was commemorated as a solemn kind of a public holiday there. They would have an annual event commemorating the massacre where they would have a bunch of speeches and vendors, kind of like going to an event today, and they'd have a keynote speaker from prominent patriots. So in the last couple of years, I've been doing my best here at this show as well, here on Path to Liberty, to do a similar type of commemoration, but highlighting one keynote speech for each year. And I did. I started off the first couple with some easy ones. There was John Hancock's in 1774. Joseph Warren's first speech, he actually gave two. His first one in 1772. And today I've got highlights from Dr. Benjamin Church, 250 years ago, yesterday in 1773. It was actually a pretty great speech, but if you don't know Benjamin Church or any history about him, it's an almost jaw-dropping twist at the end of this episode. First, a quick recap, though, on a couple of these other ones. Here from Joseph Warren's speech, he focused on a natural rights foundation, and he had plenty of warnings about standing armies. Here he said, he called standing armies the ready engines of tyranny and oppression. And he closed his first speech in 1772 with one of my favorite quotes, reminding us that two of the most important principles of the American Revolution are being A, pro-liberty, and B, anti-empire. You don't get a lot of people on both sides of that equation today. I don't think you can be on one or just the other. But he put it this way: may our land be a land of liberty, the seat of virtue, the asylum of the oppressed, a name and a praise in the whole earth, until the last shock of time shall bury the empires of the world in one common undistinguished ruin. I will link to Dave's article. I've got this episode covering Joseph Warren's episode, his speech. I've got John Hancock's here in just a moment. And all the other stuff, the original source documents, Benjamin Church's speech text, etc., over in the show notes. I publish a blog post about 1 to 2 hours after the live stream is done. You'll find that over at 10thamendmentcenter.com/path-to-liberty. And while I'm mentioning that, a quick aside here, I want to take a quick moment to say hello to everyone out in the live chat. I appreciate you guys being here so much. I hope you had a great weekend. There's Dixie Strong in Bama, Larry Clark in Kansas, Tim Martin, good to see you, buddy, in Arizona, Israel in Colorado, Alt Reality, Clay Kent, Alan Hughes in Pennsylvania, Senator DT in Elkhart, Indiana. King Nobody is a great name. Central Colorado, Sharon Patriot, always good to see you as well. Dave Simmons, Douglas Fox in Tennessee, Haji in Michigan, Leslie G in Southwest Missouri, Michigan, for Murray Ray and everyone else. I appreciate you guys being here. I know I'm missing a few people. If I get a moment or so later in the episode, I will go through and see if there's any comments or questions I can get back to. And if I don't during the live stream, keep leaving comments, especially in the archive. It does two things. One, it gives me ideas for future episodes, whether you're challenging stuff that I'm saying, and I have to fix it later on and correct myself like I did on some episodes. Like, for example, I talked about John Hancock's speech. That was the first one I did on this. And I referenced him being, like, just because I've only had read things that he had written and done, so I was assuming he was a great speaker. But one of the reasons they held him back to 1774 is because he wasn't actually known as a really good speaker, and he actually had help writing the thing. And they were very concerned about how that was going to play out, but it turns out he did an amazing job. Everybody loved it. He moved the people, and maybe he turned out to be a great speaker after all. But anyways, here's one of the great quotes from John Hancock. And again, this will all be linked to over in the show notes, 10thAmendmentCenter.com/path to liberty. This is a great one. I glory in publicly avowing my eternal enmity to tyranny. A lot of people tell us today, oh, don't go talking too boastfully about noncompliance and nullification. Keep that stuff kind of quiet or they're going to come get you. But as long as people cower in fear, fear is the foundation of government power. As long as people don't have... Now, this... There is some gray area. You don't want to go sticking your neck out and risking your freedom in order to try to advance freedom, but you're going to do it from a prison. That doesn't work too well. You have to have some kind of middle road. You have to be proudly in support of liberty and against tyranny so other people can rally to the cause. I mean, for example, we know John Dickinson in 1767, just a few years before this, he specifically in his letters from a farmer in Pennsylvania, he said, you know, even the smallest step, we just have to take the smallest step, smallest statements and make them very public so other people can be aware of them and draw more people, build more courage. Each step leads to another and another and another. So John Hancock, I glory. This was a guy who was totally rich. He had no reason. I mean, I know people who hate John Hancock and hate the American Revolution want to just paint him as an opportunist and just out to get money. But he actually risked everything in order to support the revolution. He could have been on the other side and probably been much more wealthy. I glory in publicly avowing my eternal enmity to tyranny. And here's another one that I loved. Unfortunately, the people have forgotten. But he said, surely you will never tame... You never will tamely suffer this country to be a den of thieves. Well, maybe they weren't back then. Remember, my friends, he said, from whom you sprang. It looks like the people for generations have unfortunately forgotten from whom they sprang. And here's the episode up on the screen here if you're watching. Remembering Boston Massacre Day, John Hancock edition. That was from 2021, March 5th. And he also specifically reminded us, I thought something really interesting in that speech by Hancock, was that the revolution, we're taught in government-run schools, that the revolution was really just about taxation without representation. They had some taxes on tea, and we didn't have the right representatives there. And so therefore, there's no reason to resist anything today because we've got representatives, and even though they're taxing us, at least we have our representatives, and if we've got a problem with it, they want us to believe we just change those representatives, and now that's all we get to do. But Hancock pointed out in that speech, and I covered it in that episode, specifically that taxation without representation wasn't the root cause of the problem. It was an outgrowth of the Declaratory Act of 1766, where Parliament claimed power over the colonies in all cases whatsoever. So unlimited, centralized British supremacy, kind of how they manipulate and treat, manipulate us to believing that their twisted version of the Supremacy Clause of today, not much difference at all. So he actually said that the real problem, and Thomas Paine, many others said the same thing, was this power over the colonies in all cases whatsoever. But with all that, here let's get to Dr. Benjamin Church's March 5th, 1773 speech at the Massacre Day event. He went through some pleasantries. He's not up to the task. This was a common thing. You can read the whole. I've got it over here from Monticello.org. You can read the whole thing. But after some pleasantries, he gets right into railing against unlimited centralized power. Much of his speech was about basically a line in the sand. They're authorized to do this stuff, general things, and everything else is reserved to us here. They have to have expressly delegated powers. It sounds like a precursor. Well, I think you'll figure out where I'm going with this. He said, "It would shock humanity should I attempt to describe those barbarous and tragic scenes which crimson the historic page of this wretched and detestable Constitution." He's talking about the unwritten British Constitution. "Where absolute dominion is lodged in one person, where one makes the whole and the whole is nothing. So the more centralized the power, the less that the population, the people at large, have meaning. So if there's only one person, that's the worst it can get. What motives," he said, "what events could have been able to subdue men endowed with reason to render themselves the mute instruments and passive objects of the caprice of an individual?" Of course, John Adams wrote, "Fear is the foundation of most governments." We know that fear, ignorance and fear lead to this type of thing. Jefferson had written, "If populate people wants to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, if a nation wants to be ignorant and free, it wants what never was and what never will be." So if you don't have courage and knowledge, that's what kind of leads to that. But he's asking that question kind of rhetorically. We've got people with reason and rational ability. What would drive us to be okay with this type of thing? Again, he sounds, where he's getting a little bit more, this sounds a little bit like a precursor to Article 2 of the Articles of Confederation, which I covered in an episode last week on the 1st, and then also the 10th Amendment. He said, "Mankind no doubt intended by the original compact a permanent exemption of the subject body from any claims which were not expressly surrendered for the purpose of obtaining the security and defense of the whole." Okay, so the TLDR, there's a compact, it's unwritten between the people and the government, like, and they expressly delegated certain things for government to do, everything else was automatically reserved. This is really a precursor, kind of like Patrick Henry's views in his resolve, 1765 resolves against the Stamp Act, or James Otis Jr. in 1761 saying an act against the Constitution was void. They're saying they're only authorized to do certain stuff. And he specifically is talking about expressly surrendered or expressly delegated is how they use the term in the articles and later. He said, "Can it possibly be conceived that they would voluntarily be enslaved by a power of their own creation?" Again, this is really a line in the sand argument. Joseph Warren's focused more on natural rights and standing armies. And here he is talking about delegated and reserved powers, Benjamin Church, the following year. Again, he said, "The constitution of magistrate does not therefore take away that lawful defense against force and injury allowed by the law of nature. We are not to obey a prince ruling above the limits of power entrusted to him." There's so much there. He's literally just saying, like, okay, again, the prince, whatever, elected or unelected, the people in power, the people who have power, only have those powers that are entrusted or delegated to them. And as soon as they go beyond that line, we aren't supposed to be obeying them. We're supposed to be resisting and opposing them. He said, "For the Commonwealth, by constituting a head, does not deprive itself of the power of its own preservation." And of course, he referred to that as a natural right. This is the same type of thing that Thomas Jefferson said, citing these revolutionary principles in his draft for the Kentucky Resolutions of 1798 against the hated Alien and Sedition Acts of John Adams and his team. But he put it this way, every state, and when he's talking about states here, he's not talking about the state governments, he's talking about the people of every state and the delegated powers to their own state government. Every state has a natural right, in cases not within the compact, to nullify of their own authority all assumption of powers by others within their limits. So again, it's a natural right. If a government is there as an agent of the people, and or the people of the several states in our scenario, if they are an agent of the people and they do stuff within their bounds, fine. If they go beyond that limit, you have a natural right to resist them. And that's what Benjamin Church was saying. That's what Jefferson was saying some years later. Here back to Church. He said, government or magistracy, whether supreme or subordinate, is a mere human ordinance. So even whether it's executive king or any form of government, this is a human creation. It's created by people, and that power has to flow from somewhere. We can think about people like George Mason, who specifically said, all power is from the people. Mercy Otis Warren said the same thing. All power is from the people, and they have an incontestable right to check the creatures of their own creation. So government is a mere human ordinance, and the laws of every nation are the measures of government power. You can read it yourself. And kings, the servants of the state, when they degenerate into tyrants, forfeit their right to government. You can hear some precursors to what ended up in the Declaration of Independence. Even Alexander Hamilton had the same type of view. And when Hamilton, we tweeted this morning, if Hamilton sounds better than almost everyone in office today, you know you were in a seriously bad place. But Hamilton put it like this in Federalist Number 33. He's talking about the Supremacy Clause, and he's trying to respond to some claims that they'll just be able to do whatever they want. But he's saying, no, they only have the powers that are delegated to them, and they're only supreme in those acts that are pursuant to the delegated powers. Now, of course, the way he read them were way too broad, but that's a different episode. But here's how he put it. The principle is still very solid. It will not follow from this doctrine, again, of supremacy, that acts of the large society, which are not pursuant to its constitutional powers, but which are invasions of the residuary authorities of the smaller societies, will become the supreme law of the land. So this is just what Benjamin Church was saying. As soon as they go beyond that limit, they forfeit their right to have any kind of obedience. And if they become tyrants, they forfeit their right completely, and then you go even further. And that's exactly what Hamilton is saying here as well in Federalist 33. They are acting pursuant to those powers delegated to them. Are they their acts supreme? If they aren't, they are not the supreme law of the land. And more importantly, he said, these will be merely acts of usurpation and will deserve to be treated as such. So, and they also deserve to be treated as a usurpation with disdain, hatred, of course, resistance. Again, back to Benjamin Church, I keep thinking Joseph Warren. Anyways, numberless have been the attacks made upon our free Constitution. Numberless the grievances we now resent. But the Hydra mischief is the violation of my right as a British American freeholder in not being consulted in framing those statutes I am required to obey, talking about at least some form of consent, government by consent. That's pretty hard to accomplish, but at least he's going for that. He said the authority of the British monarch over this colony was established, and his power derived from the roving charter. By that, we are entitled to a distinct legislation. So again, this is about a line in the sand. He only has that power through the charter. The charter is the act of the people. Thomas Paine said pretty much the same thing. A constitution is not an act of government. It's an act of the people constituting a government. So if you think about the flow of where the power comes from, then ultimately the people have the final say. It's just up to them to use their power, whether the government happens to like it or not. And then he gets into the question of what makes a free people. He said, therefore, the liberty of the people is exactly proportioned to the share the body of the people have in the legislature and the check placed in the Constitution on executive power. That state only is free where the people are governed by laws which they have a share in making, and that country is totally enslaved where one single law can be made or repealed without the interposition or consent of the people. So anytime you live in a scenario, even if they're not using their power in a bad way, as soon as you have a single person with the capability, with a single act, without the representatives of the people being involved, making something that's law, I mean, we see this with executive orders, for example, all the time. He said that is a state of total tyranny, of being enslaved. Now, St. George Tucker said almost the same thing. Many years later, he wrote the first legal commentary on the Constitution for the United States. It was very Jeffersonian in its approach. This was a view of the Constitution of the United States in 1803. He said, "It is the due restraint and not the moderation of rulers that constitutes a state of liberty." Again, it's not just because people who have power happen to be doing the right thing. That's not a free people. That's a population on its knees, getting lucky or begging for scraps. He said, "As the power to oppress, though never exercised, is still a state of slavery." So as long as they have that power, that is a state of slavery to people like St. George Tucker. Now, both Tucker in 1803 and Church in 1773, they were reiterating the Penman of the Revolution's view. That's John Dickinson again in his Letters from a Farmer in Pennsylvania. I think this is letter number 7. This was in 1767, written in response to the hated Townsend Acts of that time. And for those of you who heard me mention this before, these were the most widely read documents on American liberty up until publication of Thomas Paine's Common Sense in 1776. The views in this were very widely accepted. And he asked that question. This is the same type of thing that Benjamin Church was getting at in this speech. But Dickinson was asking that question. What makes a free people? He said, "For who are a free people? Not those over whom government is reasonable and equitably exercised, but those who live under a government so constitutionally checked and controlled that proper provision is made against it being otherwise exercised." Short version again, TLDR, you're not free just because government is treating you well. You're still in a state of slavery, hoping that government will continue doing this the right way forever. And that never happens. And that's why the only people who are a free people are those who know how to exercise their rights, whether the government wants them to or not. Or as Thomas Jefferson put it, a free people claim their rights as derived from the laws of nature and not as a gift of their chief magistrate. And again, back to Benjamin Church. After going through all the structure, and again, I will link to his full speech in the show notes. It's got all the notes, etc., with it as well over at Monticello.org. He went through quite a bit about this structure of the system, the power of the people, and then he wraps up with this big reminder. And I've got the twist coming up here in just a moment that is just fascinating for those of you who don't know. But let us not forget the distressing occasion of this anniversary, the sullen ghosts of murdered fellow citizens. He's talking about the people killed in March of 1770. He was the physician. Benjamin Church was the doctor who examined the body of Crispus Attucks and treated some of the wounded right there on the street. He was there firsthand. He was the physician for the Patriots. So he knew what was going on. He said, "But words can poorly paint the horrid scene. Defenseless, prostrate, bleeding countrymen, the piercing, agonizing groans, the mingled moan of weeping relatives and friends. These best can speak." And he's calling on the people to do something now. He's calling on them to take a stand against the empire. He said, "To rouse the lukewarm into noble zeal, to fire the zealous into manly rage against the foul oppression of quartering troops in populous cities in times of peace." So he wanted them to be into a manly rage in 1773. Again, if you think about it, it's pretty powerful stuff. He draws a line in the sand between delegated and reserve powers over and over and over. Talks about, well, as soon as you go beyond that, you're a tyrant. You don't deserve obedience. We need to resist you. And then he rallies people to the cause. But here's the big twist. And here's from the Battlefields Trust over at battlefields.org. Again, all this stuff will be linked to in the show notes over at 10thAmendmentCenter.com/path to liberty. Well, I'll just do the spoiler. Benjamin Church was a turncoat. He was a traitor. In July 1775, the Continental Congress authorized the creation of a medical department with a director general and chief surgeon, Dr. Benjamin Church. July 1775, this is just months after Lexington and Concord. This is literally, I think this was just weeks, maybe 1 week after the declaration and the causes of why they were taking up arms, drafted by John Dickinson and Thomas Jefferson, passed unanimously by the Second Continental Congress. "We will continue to fight until the threat of you attacking and taking our liberty is gone, and we will not put our arms down before then." So, in other words, you're going to have to lose. So they created a medical department, and he was elected to serve as the director general, which ultimately made him the first Surgeon General of the United States. However, he only served that role for 3 months before he was court-martialed on accusations of treason. Now, I'm not an expert in the history of the treason of Dr. Benjamin Church, but it turns out he was passing along there. He didn't even deny it himself. He was passing along letters to a contact through a mistress to General Gage. And General Gage is the guy who marched on Lexington and Concord. There is some suggestion in the history that maybe he was the guy that was kind of giving him information that led to that attack. We often think of Benedict Arnold as that first, you know, like, if you're going to be a traitor, don't be Benedict Arnold on us. But really, Benjamin Church was probably the first. There was a court-martial, as they said here. George Washington was the presiding guy on that court-martial. He was found guilty. George Washington did not want to come up with the sentence for him. I think he was one of the leaders of the Sons of Liberty. This was a very well-known patriot. I think this was very painful. He admitted to passing on the letters. He made an excuse. He's like, oh, I was trying to throw him off. And I don't think anyone really bought that. But George Washington turned this information over to the Continental Congress, said, you know, we found him guilty. We're going to leave the punishment up to you. The Massachusetts Provincial Congress kicked him out. He was sent to prison, I think in Connecticut. And then the Continental Congress decided to banish him rather than execute him. So he was held in very high regard, but he died en route to where he was going. And the interesting part is his widow and his family were pensioned by the British government. And I think that in and of itself. Now, someone might have some interesting history that maybe the whole thing was a conspiracy and Washington and everyone else was wrong and he was really one of the good guys with us, or maybe he flipped the switch. Maybe it was because he had a mistress and he was in a bunch of debt and he was desperate and he did bad things. Human nature leads us to do a lot of bad things. But man, I think the lesson here is very straightforward. John Adams put it this way: trust no man living with power to endanger the public liberty, including the people who tell you, trust no one with power to endanger the public liberty. Trust no one who's the head of one of the leaders of the Sons of Liberty. Trust no one who's calling you to resist. You can't trust people with power, because ultimately, human nature, the maxim, they will lead us astray over and over. Here's Samuel Adams some years earlier. Put it this way: it is a very great mistake to imagine that the object of loyalty is the authority and interest of one individual man, however dignified by the applause or enriched by the success of popular actions. Again, it's a great message from Benjamin Church. Many of the things that he did, and I've seen some things that kind of poo-pooed there was always some question about his loyalty. Samuel Adams, John Hancock, and many others, they trusted him. I mean, he was a friend of the cause. He was with them for many years. He was on the street treating the bloody during the Boston Massacre. And he flipped a switch in the coming years. We don't know. We really will never know. And maybe other people know better than I do. But I don't think any historian really can actually do anything other than guess what the motivation was for all this and what the real facts were. We can see the letters that have been sent back and forth. They actually have them on file at the Gage Library. I think it's in Michigan, of all places. I'm not sure how that all works out. But if you want to read more about that history, there's a bunch of blog posts done by my favorite historian of that era, called a guy named J.L. Bell, who has a blog called Boston 1775. I'm going to link to it. I'm linking to a URL of the tag of Dr. Benjamin Church, and you can see all kinds of stuff about the letter, et cetera, that will be in the show notes at 10thamendmentcenter.com/path-to-liberty. Just looking over in the live chat and see if there's any comments or questions I can quickly get back to. I just got a few minutes here. Haji says Jefferson for the win there. Absolutely. And that's really the message. Whether Benjamin Church did the wrong thing later or not, whether Jefferson did the wrong thing in his life or not, the message is correct no matter what. When government does stuff that they're not authorized to do, it's up to the people to keep them in check. And if the people don't do that, they shouldn't be surprised when government grows and grows and grows, no matter who you have in office, because it's not about the people, it's about the power. Let's see if there's anything else. Senator DT says, it's an understanding that a cousin of mine was the judge in the trial of the British soldiers that fired on the citizens of Boston, where John Adams was one of the attorneys. That's fascinating. That's fascinating history. See if there's anything else here. I'll have to scroll through a little bit later. I appreciate you guys leaving your feedback. If you really want to help us get this kind of word out, these foundational historical principles, and then on top of it, how to implement them in response to the largest government in history once again today, supporting the Constitution and liberty no matter what they try to do. The odds are heavily stacked against us, but ultimately, duty is ours. We have to do what's right no matter what the odds are. If you want to support us in that effort, you can join us for as little as $2 a month. Nothing helps us get that job done more than the financial faith and support of our members. $2 a month. We also have annual, 5-year, and lifetime options over at 10thAmendmentCenter.com. I'd be extremely grateful for any consideration you can give to join us today. And thank you to everyone. I see a bunch of people out there who are members. I don't want to dox anybody, but I appreciate you guys putting your faith behind our work, your financial faith. I know it's very difficult with the way the Fed and the government itself is destroying the purchasing power through their inflation and their spending, their insane spending. So I'm very grateful for any of that fiat you can throw our way. Again, 10thAmendmentCenter.com/members. Again, I appreciate you guys being here. I hope this was interesting. I hope it was educational. I'll get that blog post published in a couple of hours over at 10thAmendmentCenter.com/path to liberty. I hope you had a great weekend. Your Monday's off to a good start, and I hope to see you next time here on the Path to Liberty.